You were born and grew up in California.
That's right.
So, what was your first experience with mathematics way back?
I wasn't into math contests or anything. Mm-hmm. I liked geometry and I liked proofs of the Pythagorean theorem. Mm-hmm. But I was actually thinking of going into physics, not into mathematics, when I went to college.
Mm-hmm.
But when I went to college, I would always take the physics test and get every problem wrong, and I could get the math problems right. So at some point, I switched over and decided math was more easy for me to figure out the answers to.
Now, what was the attraction of science, physics in particular, early on?
I thought it was important to mm-hmm. the real world, and I thought math was sort of just a tool we used. So I don't know. I had decided physics was more glamorous or something,
uh-huh.
which is funny because I never actually liked. I never took a physics class I really liked, or at least not at that point. But
mm-hmm.
But I just felt like it was more important and serious than mathematics.
So in grade school and high school in particular, were you more oriented toward the sciences anyway then?
Yeah, I was actually, I know this is going to sound stupid, but my main interest was actually in reptiles. And I used to do a lot of hunting for lizards and snakes. So I was naturally inclined more towards biology.
Uh-huh.
My dad was a veterinarian, and then later he was a biology teacher at a community college.
Uh-huh.
And so I was really much more interested in biology than mm-hmm. in anything else until I went to college.
Right. So when you went to college, what were you looking for?
Well, I didn't like writing at mm-hmm. all. I hated writing.
Mm-hmm.
And my main goal was to take courses where you didn't have to write papers,
uh-huh.
which is strange because I sort of in the back of my head thought I was going to become like a lawyer or something,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't like writing. So mm-hmm. so math was the ideal subject to take because you didn't have to write papers.
Mm-hmm.
So, but this was back in the 70s, so
mm-hmm.
You had to have a typewriter mm-hmm. and things like that. So it was harder to mm-hmm. write then than it is now, I think.
So what was your choice of college then?
Well, I as a freshman, I went to MIT for 1 year. And I liked it, but I came back and went to Berkeley after 1 year at MIT. I thought I was more comfortable in California
mm-hmm.
And sort of near where I grew up. So, saved a lot of money going to Berkeley over MIT
uh-huh.
also.
Yes.
Yeah, my parents had saved money for me to go to expensive college, and it turned out that by going to Berkeley, and tuition was like
mm-hmm.
I forgot, it was like $179
mm-hmm.
a quarter back then.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I pretty much used the money I would have spent at MIT to go
mm-hmm.
through undergrad and grad school
mm-hmm.
at Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
So
at Berkeley you continued right from undergraduate into a graduate degree at Berkeley.
Yeah, I didn't apply to any graduate schools. I was sort of wanted a vacation after undergraduate,
mm-hmm.
but I sort of just at the last second applied to graduate school there and got in. I think after a quarter I wanted a vacation, so I actually dropped out for about half a year. But then I eventually realized that I thought I could just do math on my own. I didn't need a
mm-hmm.
degree. At some point, I realized that that wasn't really the way that you could actually seriously do math. You needed to get, a degree and have a little more exposure
right.
to things.
As you did, as you transitioned from physics to mathematics in your undergraduate years, when did you start developing interest in particular areas of mathematics, or did you remain broadly interested?
I got I was pretty interested from the start in areas pretty close to what I work on.
Mm-hmm.
I was first interested in applied math, and then I was pretty quickly interested in special functions.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember as a junior, back then there were lots of used bookstores, and
mm-hmm.
you could go and look for books, and I used to go and find books that I was interested in and buy them, so I
mm-hmm.
accumulated all these these books. And so I got interested in special functions, and I thought, okay, I'll study them systematically.
Uh-huh.
So I studied the gamma function, and that wasn't too much topic. And then the next one was the Riemann zeta function, and I started there and never finished. But you know, I did manage to go through Titchmarsh's book. You know, probably did the first few hundred pages. I wrote the first, you know, 250 pages into a notebook and tried to figure out everything in it. So, yes, I was pretty. And then from there, I went into. I was interested in applications to number theory. Eventually, I never actually took a course in number theory, but eventually, all these things sort of led towards number theory. When you apply analysis to it. So.
So when it came to choosing a thesis topic, how did that come about?
Well, at the time at Berkeley, the person I who would have been natural to work with was Lamer. But even though, as I later found out, he's a very he was a very friendly guy, he sort of was intimidating. And so the only other person that was close to my interest was Sherman Lehman. So and he at least had done work on the zeta function. So I went to him and I said, I've already been studying this stuff, and I'm interested in working on it. And I had an interesting experience, which was we had they had a two seminar. You had to take two seminars. That was a requirement for your PhD. And I had was not a very clued in. I didn't like talk to other graduate students. I knew almost nobody. I mean, I actually got my PhD. I was within 6 months of my PhD before I realized that you actually have to apply for jobs, believe it or not. I had never even thought. I thought I would just teach at community college, and so anyhow, I saw that in the fall, Lehman was going to give a he was going to give a seminar on analytic number theory. He was going to use this book by Ingham on prime numbers. So I just assumed everyone taking the seminar would read the whole book before you started. So during the summer, I read the whole book, you know, all the way through, and I understood everything. So I showed up the first day, and it turned out that we weren't even going to cover more than the first couple of chapters. And and no one else had even really looked at it. And, you know, by the end of the semester, we got into maybe page 50. And so I sort of was sort of over-prepared for for that particular topic. I mean, but I think I naturally was interested in it.
So what was your thesis topic?
It was on prime number. In fact, it isn't too much different than what I've been doing ever since. It was on... It was on what we call pair correlation of zeros, the zeta function applied to prime numbers. And in that thesis, I gave a proof of a result. Heath Brown had just proved it just about a year before that. On Heath Brown proved that if you assume the Riemann hypothesis and the pair correlation conjecture for zeros of the zeta function, then you could show that there are infinitely often gaps between primes that are arbitrarily close to the average, arbitrarily smaller than the average. And that's actually what GPY proved unconditionally. And so that was in my thesis, actually, was was that result, but it was assuming the Riemann hypothesis and pair correlation. So, yes, that was what I did my thesis on. A few years later, we... I was working with Montgomery, and we proved pretty much that pair correlation is equivalent to a formula on primes and short intervals. I mean, knowing one formula, asymptotic formula gives the other, and vice versa. And at that point, I realized that, you know, there wasn't any real way to use, it wasn't really the right way to study primes, because you were basically getting equivalent statements. The only way to break that sort of wall would be to study one or the other. And, you know, the thing about zeros as zeta function is that we don't know anything about them. I mean, we don't know their vertical or horizontal position. And we don't know the most simple things about them, like are they multiple zeros or spaced far apart? And so I sort of realized I should study primes rather than zeros. You know, at least primes... you know, they're always at least one apart. In fact, they're usually always at least two apart. And for zeros, that would be an amazing addition of knowledge to know there was some sort of minimal spacing. But we don't have that. So yeah, so basically then I started working on gaps between primes right after that. I never quit, actually.
But at some point along the way there, you had to find a job.
Yeah. Well, what happened was I realized I had to get a job. I got my PhD in June, and I think around February, I was still working on my thesis, and I realized I had to apply for jobs, but by that time, most of the jobs had been taken, and it was a pretty bad job market in 1981, but there were, you know, jobs you could get, and so I got a few offers, and I went for a temporary job in Minnesota at the University of Duluth, University of Minnesota Duluth. And so I was there for a year, and, you know, we had to teach pretty, it was pretty a lot of teaching, and it was fun, but it was tough to get my research done. And so I applied for, back then you had, of course, write individual letters and type them on your typewriter and send them out. And I sent out like 25 applications to places that I thought would be good to go to do research, and I applied for not tenure track jobs, just temporary jobs. And I got 24 rejections, and the only one I didn't get rejected from was for the Institute for Advanced Study, because I said to them I was willing to go there without any pay, which turned out the money that was supposed to pay for MIT, actually, I still had some of it. So I actually had enough money to go for a year without any pay. And the stock market, I think right then, inflation was really high, and this had been in the stock, and it was earning like 20%. I mean, interest rates alone were like, if you remember 1981, were, you know, like 12 or 14%. So basically, I went to the Institute the next year. I was going to go back to Duluth, but after I'd been at the Institute for like 6 months, I just couldn't go back there because it was just, you know, there wasn't any way to get a permanent job there. And I was working a little too hard. So by that, by being at the Institute for a year, and they did eventually give me some money too, I met all the people that I know in the field. Everyone who I later worked with, I met there, like Brian Connery, Steve Gonick, I met Heath Brown, Bombieri, Selmer. I met everybody. And by going to the Institute, it was, I mean, I didn't know it. It was a strategically good thing to do, because when you applied for jobs coming from the Institute, you just were taken a lot more seriously. In fact, I blew a job interview because I had this job interview, I think, with somebody, and I said I'm interested not just in the tenure track job, but, you know, I would take a temporary job too, and that they instantly lost all interest in me. Know if this should be in the tape. Maybe I won't mention who it was. I blew that. So then I got a job offer from San Jose State, and I had a couple other job offers, but I was ready to go back to the Bay Area.
So you've been there ever since?
I've been there ever since, and initially I was thinking of leaving because the teaching load was pretty heavy, and they didn't have any mechanism to give you time off to do research when I first got there. And then we got this dean who had come from NASA, this physicist came from NASA, and he became the provost, or the equivalent of the provost back then. And he just said, well, we can give time off for research. This is silly. And so, like, right after that happened, I was getting a course off each, I got a course off each year, or sometimes two. And just because of this one guy, and within a year he was fired as provost, and ended up having to go back into physics, and had to go through the tenure process and stuff. But they never removed that program. They complain about it. They never removed it. So, you know, just cutting a course out and finding other ways to handle that made it possible for me to, you know, still do good work, I think.
So you found a way to balance your teaching load and your research.
Yeah, but you know, you have to put a little bit of effort into not you know, you have to do certain things to do that. Like, like one of the things which is pretty helpful is if you're near the campus, you can teach every day. So you can teach courses that are 5 units instead of 3 units. But, you know, a 5-unit course is no more work than a 3-unit course. The only additional work is physically standing in front of the class. And in fact, that's the fun part of it. So, yeah, so if you're willing to do that, and, you know, sometimes there's committee work you can do that is much easier than teaching a course. So I remember my first 2 years, there were 2 semesters I think I taught 4 courses, and that was just 4 3-unit courses, and there were like 3 different types of courses. It was just too much, and I've never taught, since then I've never taught more than 3 classes, and frequently I've taught 2, so it's feasible.
But there are ways then also to keep your research going and your collaborations with
a
wide variety of people.
Yeah. I mean, you can use the internet, of course. Yeah. The internet only came in, I guess, around, we had BitNet. We had stuff around 85 and 86, but I mean, it really came in strong,
around,
I guess.
Around 1990.
Yeah, around 1990. And by 2000, you know, with tech and stuff, you don't have to actually be in the same location. I mean, I guess I've never really done work with people where we stood at a blackboard. I mean, I've done that, but I've never done that every day where you go in and stand in front of a blackboard with somebody and work out stuff. I've always tended to, you know, do it individually and then talk to them. And, so it doesn't really matter.
Now, how did your relationship with the American Institute of Mathematics, AIM, arise?
Well,
they're quite a center, and
right. Well,
in your neighborhood.
I've known Brian. Brian was at the Institute in 82, 83 when I went there, so I've known Brian since then. And of course, Brian and Kevin McCurley and a few other people all came out of Santa Clara University, which is 1 mile from where my house is now. So, you know, and we're connected through Jerry Alexanderson and stuff. So, yes, I guess it was through Brian. Brian initially, I think, you know, Fry wanted to make a library down in Morgan Hill. And Brian, I think, was the one who sort of convinced him he should actually run an institute and bring people in to do research. And so, I'm not super involved with AIM, but I've been, you know, I've been going to their things for a long time.
Right. Yeah. AIM seems to have been a nice way to bring people together, though.
Yeah.
Collaborate very. I mean, they emphasize their collaborative approach.
Right.
And so on. So.
Yeah. So they've been doing. They've brought in a lot of people. They always used to have 3 or 4 people working there, and it was a good way to, you know, get people that had, you know, had finished their PhD, but you know, didn't have jobs or didn't have jobs that weren't going to be a lot of teaching, to give them a couple years to really get their research done. And, that's worked pretty well, I think. So now I guess they're building their
palace.
The palace is actually, I think it's started. I mean, it's had every problem in the world. And, I think the last one was they're within a half, they're really close to a major PG&E gas line. And that gas, I mean, before there were some red-legged frogs in the fire. But now the gas line, they had to be convinced that pounding in the foundations wouldn't harm the gas line. So, you know, it's a funny, I don't think they don't really need that institute. I mean, it'd be nice, I suppose, but they're okay where they are now in the Fry's building in Palo Alto.
Although I think they've just moved, or are about to move. I thought I got a notice about that.
Well, our conference next week is still there, as far as I know.
All right.
Yeah, so I think I don't think that building's come very far. I think they've just done something. I know Fry bought $2 million worth of steel. And supposedly the supports are now going in.
Right.
So I think they're moving along finally. And but I think they're going to take it over for golf tournaments when they have them there too. So it will be mathematicians and I've been told that if you'd like to play golf, it's going to be the perfect place to go for a math conference.
In terms of your current research directions and all, are there particular topics that you're actively pursuing yourself?
Well, you know, after GPY, that was 2005, I tried for a couple years, for several years, to try to improve on that stuff. Mm-hmm. That didn't actually do much. Mm-hmm. And then Pinson Yildirim and I finished up some things, so we had a number of papers that kept coming out. And then I decided to sort of try other things for a while. So I've been sort of doing more recreational prime number type problems. Mm-hmm. So I've been I did some work on jumping champions, and actually, thanks to Tatiana, she gave me two of her good students sort of ran. Came out of the math circle, but math circles are only for junior high.
Right.
So she had these students, but she gave them to me to work with. Mm-hmm. And so I've been working with these two kids, and I've never worked with, you know, with high school type students before. Mm-hmm. And so it took a little while to adjust, mm-hmm. because you know, I thought one of them was like, I think 15, mm-hmm. and the other one's guys, I think 16. Mm-hmm. But I was first working with a 15-year-old, and he, you know, was pretty much at maybe a sophomore, junior level in college, plus, you know, he's super smart. And mm-hmm. So I gave him a book on, I thought we would look through a book on number theory, but he wasn't real interested, because, I mean, he can just do that himself.
Mm-hmm.
So then we started, I tried to find a research problem to work on, but I found out I couldn't work on something that if it wasn't my own stuff. So we ended up just working on my own research, and we've actually finished a paper. It's on the archive, and we'll probably publish it pretty soon. And the other student was a kid who, both of them had been homeschooled, and he's a kid who sort of couldn't get into any college because he hadn't taken any of the exams. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, he's taking graduate courses in math at Stanford. Mm-hmm. The only college he could go to was Cambridge, because they're entrance through examination. And he's now at Cambridge. He passed the entrance, and he's now at Cambridge. He left a month ago, I guess. So pretty amazing. These kids, these are not your average students. Yes, we're actually working on a number of number theory problems, and probably continue through email, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's a whole new side of collaboration.
Yeah, and the guy who's at Cambridge it's pretty amazing, because he isn't even that, I mean, analytic number theory is not his interest, I don't think, but he's smart enough that, you know, he's able to, you know, work at it, you know, better than I can, really. Right. Just on intelligence, So I've been doing that, and I'm planning now to work on bounded gaps.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of my goal for the next few years. I had a bad thing, not a bad thing. I had a funny thing. I had a sabbatical in 2013, and I decided to write a book on small gaps between primes.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working away. I have about 5 chapters done. And like the first sentence in the book was, we still cannot prove that there's bounded gaps. But that was the first sentence in my book. And then right in the middle of that sabbatical, Zane comes along and proves bounded gaps. And so I sort of had to put the book on hold, because, you know, I convinced myself it was still worth writing this book and then see what happens. And then Maynard comes along and, yeah, so basically the whole subject has been turned over.
Right.
But I've eventually realized that they, you know, even the old methods, they aren't very good at getting small gaps between primes, but the questions they do answer are actually different from the small gap results, the bounded gaps. Right. So they're still actually of value. They're not really... They're just not very efficient at showing you that there are really short gaps between primes. They're more, but they're basically giving you a higher proportion of gaps that are a little smaller than average. So I decided it isn't worthless to include the old stuff as long as you're clear on what question they're trying to address.
Right.
Yeah. So I may go back and do that again.
So if you're looking a little further ahead, you know, 5, 10 years from now, where do you see yourself?
Well, you know, I've been changing. I turned 60, and I pretty much decided to retire. I've been evolving that way in the last 3 or 4 months. I think the teaching profession's changing a lot. And, I feel like, right now I'm teaching a class of 250 students, voluntarily, and it's a lot different than teaching the class with 40 or 50 or 60. And, you know, it isn't very good in a lot of ways, but the students get a lot of, you know, support they didn't used to have in the past. You know, they're connected socially, and they have all sorts of tutoring available. They have all sorts of online services, their homework's online. And, you know, if I went the whole route, which I think we will pretty soon, you know, they probably have their testing done online or through multiple choice, and pretty much the professor would just be, you know, sort of overseeing the whole thing and giving some lectures, and they could still have their lectures online. So I'm not sure I need to continue. And the sad part of it is that I substituted for a guy a couple weeks ago, and he was teaching a calculus class, and he just had his class of 40. See, I walked in there, I have 250 students, but of course only 200 show up. They're walking now, I mean, it's a zoo.
Right.
He has his 40 students, and they're all sitting there. And so I was teaching his class a couple times, and I really felt like I was wasting my time. I mean, even though I don't like the big class, the idea that I'm going to put all this effort into these 40 students, and it isn't like there's really very many good ones there. Maybe I saw that from Tatiana's students. There's a few, but it seems inefficient to be putting so much individual professor effort into, you know, helping students who aren't very good at calculus, you know, get a B or a C and then move on. And, and you know, I sort of feel like maybe it's time to move on myself. That's sort of my current thinking. So I'm thinking of trying something a little different, either not teach or just retire, or you know, try some other things. Put a little more effort into research, really, I think. So.
And there is that book
here. Yeah, there's the book. I'd rather actually. I mean, I've always preferred to work on research than to do. But the good thing about a book is that, you know, if you put in an hour, you have a page done.
Yeah.
And of course, research, you put in an hour, and you have just something in your wastebasket.
All right. You have no idea where it might go.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, often I know exactly it didn't work.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
So, but I mean, that's sort of you're used to that.
Right.
But it is discouraging if you're, you know, if you don't get anything out over a long period. So the book's always something.
Right. But you've been sort of. I mean, this is an area. That is a broader interest than usual for mathematics. I mean,
yeah.
The prime numbers and all kinds of things are prime numbers. It attracts a lot of attention. You've been at the center of both interesting research developments, but also just something that people seem to be intrinsically interested in.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and well, for the math world, it's a lot of interest.
Yeah.
I mean, but for the real world, it's still, you know, a teeny amount. I guess I get Science Magazine every week, and you know, you're lucky to see an article on math, you know, once every 3 months. I mean, not even once a month. I mean, once every 3 months. And people in biology, you know, they study like lice on some monkey's fur, and it's in there. It's, you know, and they got a 3-page spread.
Yes.
In you know, math, you have to just do something fantastic to get in there. I think that Zhang definitely got into Science Magazine. I think Maynard might have, but it was like a really short article.
Right.
And, you know, so it's not very large compared to just the other areas of
But science. Number theory and primes have a better chance than other areas.
Right, and the other...
Even at that.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's like if you're in anything abstract.
Yeah.
I mean, when's the last time you read an article on C-star algebras? Mm-hmm. I mean, and the thing is, there's probably five times as many people studying C-star algebras mm-hmm. as studying primes, mm-hmm. I would guess. Yeah. I mean, I'm not up on these things, mm-hmm. but, you know, math interest doesn't translate. It's sort of unfortunate for the other areas of math. I mean, it's sort of unfair that, you know, you study primes and you actually get...
Right.
You know, you get the attention, and it's not like the other areas don't deserve it. It's just mm-hmm. that nobody's, you know, you have to put in a huge effort just to understand what they're doing.
Yeah. But I would argue that there are also difficulties in the way they try to communicate. They don't communicate well.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, most research papers are totally inaccessible to me,
uh-huh.
and they could be a lot better.
Yeah. Or they could try to, I guess, to put some effort into something that's more understandable, too.
Even for their own colleagues. And I
yeah.
think they could do a lot more, just yeah. even for their own colleagues, because people down the hall don't know what you're doing, too, in the same math department.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunate.
Yeah. Yeah. It's true. But then I guess a lot of us, you know, we're really mm. interested in impressing our
yeah.
our friends and peers, you know. You don't really care too much what the... Yeah, I mean, I'm always amazed because I see these people that win all these awards,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, you know, from the Fields Medal mm-hmm. on down, and I've never heard of them. I
mm-hmm.
mean, and these are big shots,
mm-hmm.
big, huge shots
right.
at big universities, and I just mm-hmm. have never seen their name,
mm-hmm.
You know. I don't think I had heard of any of the Fields Medalists when I was in Korea. I mean, I had never heard of them before.
Mm-hmm.
That I, you know, but that's maybe me, but it was like
mm-hmm.
they were in fields that I didn't know anyone, and then none of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably the same, too, if I,
mm-hmm.
you know, said some of the big names in our field, they wouldn't
mm-hmm.
know them either.
Right. Right.
So, yeah, so I guess it's, you know, I guess people like, you know, it's not all bad, I guess, if you,
mm-hmm.
But it would be nice to get a little bit more. Knowledge. I mean, the trouble, I guess I'm on these committees, the people that are in biology or physics or chemistry in
mm-hmm.
particular, they're depending on money.
Yeah.
No money, they can't do their work.
Right.
And they have to publicize it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have to sort of make it seem important to
mm-hmm.
something or other. So we don't seem to have
or
that.
Or at least interesting.
Yeah, or interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it goes back to you start off with an interest in reptiles and
yeah
and
well,
things
you know,
like
I
was, that. So
I really love those reptiles. I liked hunting them and catching mm-hmm. them and keeping
mm-hmm.
them in the house. Although I didn't have very good cages, the snakes would
mm-hmm.
always escape and
oh.
go all over the house. But I think I pretty quickly realized by the time I got to high school I wasn't so interested in dissecting them or
right.
You know, counting the number
mm-hmm.
of scales across their
right.
belly and. You know, just I was just more interested in it, you know, as an observer,
yeah.
as a profession.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. Interesting. Well, thank you.
Uh-huh.
Thank you.
Sure.